Death. It's a topic few enjoy talking about. The universal equalizer. The one thing we all have in common, regardless of backgrounds or borders. In fiction, death is an omnipresent element, especially in horror, where the fear of its doom is pushed further into a realm that comes from beyond the grave. The Japanese view of death is unique and has led to a body of fiction in which death itself is a communicable disease, a contagion which corrupts and condemns. How these things function as elements of fiction has evolved over the centuries, yet at its heart, little has changed from the ancient days to the modern Japanese games, such as the Silent Hill series. What is death in Silent Hill? And how does it define the existence of the characters living and dead in the Silent Hill universe? To understand it, we have to examine the roots of Japanese stories of ghosts and death, and what they believe about death itself. The belief in ghosts is built into Shinto tradition. The belief that strong, overwhelming emotions could overpower and split the soul even while alive, causing illness and death in themselves and others, was a real concern. In the Heian period, a Japanese court official and scholar named Sugiwara no Michizane found himself on the wrong side of political machinations that led to his demotion and exile. He died in exile. And in the next few years, the daily life of the Japanese became a nightmare. Plagues, droughts, and death ruled the land, and two of those deaths were the emperor's own sons. Horrified and recognizing the suffering could only be due to the anger of a vengeful spirit, the emperor set about enshrining and honoring Michizane as a Shinto spirit. He became Tenjin, the kami of scholarship. This was a real physical reality for the ancient Japanese. Disease, plagues, famine, and natural disasters were thought to be caused by something, an unseen reality related to the existence of the dead. Death itself was a terrifying and impure thing. In Shinto tradition, heavy emphasis is given to the idea of purity, harae. Certain actions cause impurities, and those impurities hurt you physically and spiritually. That is the source of disease and disaster, the impurities that certain actions leave behind. Purity rituals were required to cleanse people after such events, and death was the worst possible impurity. The existence of death was itself thought to possess the ability to spread and cause disaster. More horrors, more death. This was a very real fear, enough so that it was present in realistic fiction as well as fantasy. The world's very first novel, The Tale of Genji, was just such a story, rooted in the real-world politics and romances of court life. It did not have gods descending from on high. There were no magical instruments or strange supernatural events, and yet it did have a vengeful spirit. The spirit was Rokujo, a court lady and one of the many lovers of the story's main character, Genji. While she falls to the background of the tale, two of Genji's other lovers suffer and die, and rumor spreads that the deaths were caused by spirit possession from the angry and jealous Rokujo. The story lacks many of the features that the ghost story would later invoke, but it is often considered the earliest of the onryo, or vengeful spirit stories in fiction. The idea would evolve and spread rapidly through other works of fiction and folktales. The Setsuwa, collections of oral stories from folk traditions, involved quite a few themes on spirits, death, and the afterlife. The largest and most popular, the Kanjaku Monogatarishu, includes dozens of such tales which involve the ordinary world colliding with the supernatural and the consequences thereof. They were simple and straightforward, reflecting a Buddhist mindset. Good actions resulted in good results, in this life or the next, and the reverse was also true. death was by no means an end or an escape from the past. This idea, that good leads to good and evil to evil, is reflected in the vengeful ghost tales, in those who return from beyond the grave to wreak havoc. It reflects the greater Japanese Buddhist idea of karma, manifesting as ghosts who avenge those that treat them poorly. The most famous of these spirits in fiction is Oiwa, from the kabuki stage play Yotsuya Kaidan. Kabuki is a very stylized Japanese stage play format, in which very little decoration is added to the stage. The focus is upon the actors and their incredible presence. Each is dressed in elaborate clothing and stylized makeup, the design of which indicates their character and temperament. A hero and a villain each have their own stylized looks, and vengeful spirits do as well. Oiwa was a young woman who was disfigured and killed by the actions of her own husband. The story involves the woman's vengeance from beyond the grave, decimating the lives of those who were involved in her death. The story was a major success. It was the first to move the vengeance-driven ghost story from the Japanese court and the distant nobility, the everyday lives of the common people. It swept the Japanese imagination, and to this day is still popular, having received over 30 different film adaptations. The stylized makeup of the kabuki actor is what led to the modern appearance of the onryo. The vengeful spirit in a kabuki story wore white burial robes with wild black hair and a pale white face. Years later, Japan would become enraptured by the occult boom, a cultural event triggered by the publication of Western occult works in Japanese for the first time, leading to an obsession with the topic. This would last for decades, raising a generation of children on the tales of otherworldly creatures hidden out of sight, and many of these would grow up to be writers of fiction focused upon these otherworldly nightmares. One of them was Suzuki Koji, who in the early 1990s would write The Ring, a book about a vengeful female spirit. And a new horror boom began, which involved a burgeoning obsession with ghost stories and the onryo. Silent Hill was in the works in the height of this ghostly era of obsession. The first Ring film released in 98. Silent Hill was released the next year. Ju-on the Curse released in 2000 and The Grudge in 2002. And in that same timeline, the ghosts and vengeful spirits of Japan would make another leap. First from books to film, and then from film to video games. In 2001, the first major Japanese horror game focused on vengeful ghosts would make its appearance, Fatal Frame. Horror in Japan in video games in the 80s and 90s focused on serial killers, murder mysteries, zombies, Lovecraftian monsters. And though Sweet Home had a plot centered upon a ghost, it wasn't exactly a onryo-style vengeance story. Fatal Frame would be the first to bring the focus of video games to the vengeful spirit, to the onryo of Japanese myth and the Shinto traditions which could defeat such creatures. And not long after, those ghosts would start appearing elsewhere, in games like Ku-on and Silent Hill 4. The revival of ancient stories had given rise to a new modern swell of interest in ancient themes, transforming old narratives into something new and horrifying. The early Silent Hill stories all revolve around vengeance. While the central narrative may involve a larger quest, often the side stories or the background of the quest is the tragedy of a young woman's suffering, her death, and subsequent return. In the first game, both Alessa and Lisa have features of the onryo, suffering in life, dying young due to the selfish actions of others, and returning from beyond the grave. Alessa's story, however, does not focus heavily on a desire for vengeance, something that adds pathos to the tragedy of her death. But Lisa eventually does seem driven to enact her own brand of justice, rising from the depths of Silent Hill to drag Kaufman into hell. In Silent Hill 2, we have Mary and Maria, She grows enraged at James's treatment of her and the reality that she must die many times to serve his journey. In other versions of the tale, it's Mary who appears at the end of the game, driven to take James's life. He can be forgiven or condemned, but either way, the story of Silent Hill 2 is that of a woman wrongfully killed, rising from the grave to face the man who murdered her. Both have intriguing twists on the Onryo narrative. For much of the story, we don't know that Alessa, Lisa, or Mary and Maria are really dead. Or we aren't exactly sure how they died. The nature of their existence is a question. We are never really sure who is real and who isn't. What created these echoes of past selves and other lives? These questions lend the story a sense of ambiguity and mystery that leave the player stunned and questioning, even years later still wondering what the truth might have been. But where we see these stories truly take an interesting turn in relation to deaths and ghosts are the third and fourth games. But let's skip to the fourth game for now. In Silent Hill 4, the player is faced with ghosts for the first time. There's no ambiguity. We see these characters die, and we see their spirits rise again, tormented and destroyed by their murders. We see how death taints them, and how that death then taints the world around us. Henry's apartment becomes possessed the further he travels through these dark worlds, changing into something that harms him. He stops commenting on his apartment as something that belongs to him and starts questioning the things that are there. He loses memories and suffers harm to his health. Hauntings appear that have to be driven away by specific items and rituals, impurities that must be purified to return the apartment to a certain level of safety. But there's nothing that will fully set it free. It is far too tainted, too much death and suffering occurring in this place. Henry's apartment, his world, is being invaded and corrupted by death. In the best endings of the game, he survives and leaves the apartment, never to return, because there is no purifying Room 302. Eileen suffers as well. She too can become tainted, and should the player not perform enough of the purification rituals, she loses her sense of self, becoming a tainted doll controlled by Walter. Defeating Walter in battle is not enough. You can win and still lose this game. It is the purifications, the rituals of Shinto tradition that defeat Walter. He is a ghost. He cannot die. In the bad ending, Henry kills him only to have a sudden headache and lose himself to the impurities. And then we see Walter still alive in the corrupted apartment. He's dead. He cannot be killed, but he can be purified. And that is the only way Henry can truly be free. And what about Silent Hill 3? It's a very different story, one with a tragic twist. In 1 and 2, we don't see characters die, and we aren't entirely sure what happened to them. In 4, we watch brutal murders and watch characters die and suffer. In 3, we have neither the ambiguity of a mystery or the horrors of a murder. We have the somber, heavy moment in which Heather walks in and finds her father's corpse. It is a brutal moment, and the beginning of Heather's quest for vengeance, a typical mythic quest in the Japanese tradition. Revenge is a common goal, even outside of ghost stories. But this is Silent Hill, a series heavily focused on the supernatural, and nothing out of the ordinary happens here. No return of a spirit, no Lisa, no Maria, no remnant, no haunting. Harry is simply gone. Heather performs a funeral for him, covering him in a white sheet and white flowers, the color of death in Japan. He's placed in his bed and left behind as Heather begins her quest for vengeance. She enters Silent Hill and eventually finds a facsimile of the same room, only her father isn't there. Blood trails across the floor and the flowers Heather placed are on the ground. Examining the bed reveals a diary. Harry's voice, his regrets reaching us from beyond the grave. Where Lisa, Alessa, Mary, and Maria, and the ghosts of 4 are all prominent presences, Harry is never really there. He is an absence. Heather calls him on the phone and we don't even hear his voice. We have no idea what he says. We don't even get to see him fighting for his life. We don't have Heather entering the room to find him breathing his last. He is simply gone. More than that, we later see that he is truly gone, removed even from his resting place. Unlike Lisa and Alessa, who exist as shimmering echoes of the dead, or Mary and Maria, unable to let James go after death, Harry steps back into the shadows of the story. Though he is murdered, it is his daughter that goes on the quest for vengeance. And how strange a death. There is no weapon, no sign of a struggle, nothing but resignation on the man's face. This is not the death of a man who would rise in anger for his own vengeance. It's the death of someone who feels guilty. Someone who has accepted their fate as something they deserve, or at the very least, cannot fight. If anything brought back Harry Mason from beyond the grave, it is the feelings of remorse he carries, that he could not save Cheryl all those years ago, that he resented and even considered abandoning a young Heather, that he kept so many secrets from her, unable to tell her the truth before the end. In those early years, fighting to save Cheryl, he stood up to violent monsters, selfish parents, and hellish demons, all to protect his daughter. Years and years of suffering later, he lets a monster take his life. What were his last thoughts, I wonder? Did he perhaps think in his final moments, "I'm the same as them"? Trauma is a hell of a thing. It warps us as much as it molds us. It's blood and black and needle scratch screeches at 3 a.m. when the thumping in your ears wraps us tight and suffocates us. And it never, ever goes away. This story doesn't end the way we want all the time. By Anton Kenker. 73 poems of trauma, terror, and the fight to win back control of the self. Wrapped in cracked scabs and pus. Available in ebook and paperback at thedragonsroost.biz or through Amazon, with an introduction written by yours truly.